Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nicholas Investment Insights. We dive into another debate this week with a friend of the show, Jonathan Rockford. Jonathan Rockford is a portfolio manager at Narrow Road Capital, a boutique Australian credit manager. He has 18 years of experience lending money and getting it back at a range of financial institutions, including Lehman Brothers and CBA. As regular listeners would know, over the last few months, we have looked several times at debt crises and how they are likely to be resolved. We've had Dr. Hale on to talk about MMT. We featured Ray Dalio's solutions to debt crises. And this week, we hear a third option, Austrian economics. Jonathan joins us today to offer a different perspective, binding together three schools of economic thought, and covers off on why he feels that central bank stimulus is the new financial heroine set to, amongst many things, create both a continual drain on productivity and exacerbate wealth inequality. Jonathan Rockford, welcome back to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Thanks for having me back, guys.
And I'm also joined by Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello, Damien.
Hi, Jim.
And just a quick reminder that before we get started, to subscribe on YouTube and click on the notification bell for when we go live or have a new webinar to watch. And follow us on your preferred podcast platform. And for those listening in live, feel free to drop in your questions in the chat box below of nucleuswealth.com/webinar to have them answered along the way. We'll jump into the agenda today. So we'll kick off with an overview of Keynesian MMT and Austrian economic schools of thought and the differences between them. We'll then be looking at an Austrian economics overview. We'll run through some issues with the Keynesian view. We'll give out some examples of countries that are going cold turkey, what is likely versus what is right. And then, of course, wrap all this up in our investment implications on how we run money here every day at Nucleus Wealth. So to get us started, I'll hand over to Damien Klassen to run us through the three schools of economics. Damien.
Thanks, Tim. Yeah, I won't, not going to make this a huge economics lesson, but I just sort of, I'll give a little bit of background just for listeners before we got into to Jonathan's, just to frame it, because I think we've spoken about a few different things in sort of separate buckets, and it's worth just sort of trying to bring it all together a bit. So I might start with the Keynesian side. So, and these are, I guess I'm talking about all of these in the context of debt crises and whether we're seeing, you know, when we start to see downturns and as well, you know, coming out of that downturn in a sustainable manner. So the Keynesian side is basically, you know, suggesting that you use government spending to kickstart economies. It's got this, one of the key tenets of it is this paradox of thrift. So the problem is that everyone starts saving. And so because when I spend money, that's other people's incomes. And so when I start saving, that means other people then lose part of their incomes. And if those people also start saving as well, then, you know, more people lose part of their incomes. And if everyone does it together, you sort of end up in this problem. And that the government needs to step in at that stage and be what they call the spender of last resort. And, you know, I guess that it's primary one that they point to is the Great Depression and you know, in effect, World War II being a massive amount of Keynesian spending. And so that's sort of like a quick overview of what it's espousing. The key criticism of it is the idea with the broken window fallacy, which is basically that if you break a window, then that means you need to hire somebody to go and, you know, put the new glass in, and so therefore that's a positive for GDP. And whereas, you know, obviously we all go around breaking windows and fixing each other's windows, we're not doing a whole lot for economic growth, even though it might look that way in the statistics. MMT is, or modern monetary theory. Effectively, what they're talking about is saying that governments, you know, I guess in terms of borrowing and taxing and all these types of things, is a bit of an illusion. If you've got your own printing press, effectively if you can print your own currency, then your only real constraint is inflation. You can just literally print money directly and use that to get to full employment. And and then if things get a bit hot in terms of inflation, then you can use increased taxes or you can issue bonds in order to sort of suck some of the liquidity out of the market. I guess in terms of the there's I guess the key thing with modern monetary theory is most other economists think that it's bunk. There's not a lot of support in the mainstream area for it. It is relatively new though, and so it still hasn't matured as a theory in the eyes of the world. So there's probably most of the arguments against it tend to be that the MMT arguments are relatively fluid, and so people tend to attack them in one area and then they turn it back around and all of a sudden that's a feature, not a bug. And so I think there probably needs a bit more work before you can come up with some a more concise list of what people find is right and wrong with MMT. The Austrian school is a lot about individual actions and talking about the individuals within an economy being the most important thing. It's not about a big sort of top-down view, and that what's more important is how things come from the bottom up. They talk about some of the, in terms of inflation, I guess in terms of downturns, is that what's important is the direction of inflation as opposed to stability. So I guess it's partly along that, if you've got stable inflation, whether it's high or low, doesn't really stimulate or detract. It's more when you're getting changes in inflation. The main criticisms come in terms of the lack of models. I think a lot of the other schools of economics like to have econometric models or sort of big picture models of how the world works, and the Austrian school doesn't, and that sort of they get a lot of flack for that. Questions. There's a lot of questions about the empirical evidence and that it's too micro focused. So that's sort of our three basic sides. Also wanted to just highlight a few other points, I guess, is that one is we spoke a lot about the Dalio stuff 2 weeks ago and his view on how you get out of debt crises and the whole view about long-term and short-term debt, how you get this longer-term build-up of debt, but there's short-term debt cycles within that. So it's worth noting that a lot of his stuff is more about empirical and practical and how things are being used, but as Jonathan will point out, I'm sure a lot of his solutions are mainly on the sort of Keynesian side of it. It's the other two that I think is well worth adding into the mix as well, because it's sort of some of their theories sort of permeate within different ranges of these. One is that the Hyman-Minsky, which is basically that if you get lots of stability, then eventually you'll get instability because people will either gear up or they'll push everything to the limit, and so. And that sort of falls into some of these in terms of those, how much debt is too much debt, and that people will just keep pushing the limits until they break, effectively. And the other one I just wanted to highlight as well is that less well known than all the above, but Michael Pettis sort of gets a bit of a run on some of our blog posts and things like that as well. And I think he's got some important insights into a lot of the bits about excess saving. So if you repress wages in a country and repress consumption in a country, then a lot of that ends up in this excess savings, almost by definition, because if you're not letting people spend the money, then it must be either accruing with either governments or with companies and going back into investment projects. And then the question about where that savings goes is very important. And there's also that point about that if you've got large inequalities in economies as well, that can actually start becoming an issue as well, just in terms of the who has the money. So it's a distribution of who has the money versus who has the debt, as much as it is of the total debt. But I might leave it upon that, and we'll throw across to Jonathan to give us the Austrian view, or unless there's anything you need clarification or correction, I suppose, in what I've said.
No, I think that's a really good start, Damien. So thank you for that. Maybe just jumping on a couple of the points there. I guess where we start this sort of debate, the back and forth, is that I agree with Ray's diagnosis of debt crises and his description of factors to look for in terms of what are the things that lead up to a debt crisis. Ray does a really good job of pointing out the signposts along the way. But I think he does the wrong prognosis in terms of how to fix the problem. And so that's kind of what we'll talk to today. And if I could just touch on the three schools of economics and how that impacts debt crises. The Austrian and Keynesian schools have kind of been arguing with each other for about 100 years, back and forth on how you should deal with crises. And Austrians particularly like to think about how you should stop a crisis from happening. So Austrians can be really annoying because in the years leading up to a crisis, they're saying, hey, we're passing these signposts, it's getting worrying. These are the things that we should do to try and stop this thing getting out of control. Whereas Keynesians tend to be pretty quiet at those points, and they much more start chirping up when the crisis happens and they're like, let's kick in with the spending. Now, that may be mischaracterized a little bit. When I studied at uni, I was taught in the sort of classic Keynesian sort of way. And at that time, it was very much a case of in the times of crisis, so let's say 2009, 2010, you run a budget deficit, the government spends, the government makes up for the shortfall from corporates and consumers, and then you start getting back to balanced budgets. So 2011, you try and balance the budget. And then in 2012 through to 2019, you should have paid off the debt from the deficits in 2009 and 2010. Now, clearly, we didn't do that here in Australia, and most countries in the world didn't do that. Where MMT comes in, it's very recent, and it basically says just spend money all the time. So the Austrians would typically say, don't bail people out in the crisis. The government should hang back. The Keynesians would, in a classical way, would say the government should spend in a crisis and then run a surplus in the good times and pay it off, so at least balancing it through the cycle. And the MMT says just go for it, just spend money all the time.
And I guess it's worth noting as well is that there's, you know, we'll move on at some stage to what's likely out of this, but it's, you know, politicians love Keynesian when it's time to spend money, and they're not so hot on the whole Keynesian stuff when it's time to start saving money.
Yeah, and that's a really important point, is that I started out as a classic Keynesian and I've become more of an Austrian. I'm not a complete Austrian, but more of an Austrian thinker in terms of economics. And I think I would characterize it as Keynesians win the beauty parade, Austrians win the debate. Austrians, in my view, when you think about the outcomes, Austrians have the better arguments.
And where does MMT fit into it then?
MMT is the person with the crazy hat and the crazy clothes just running around, and you're just like, we don't listen to them. I've had debates with a couple of MMT people along the way, and it's really hard to debate with MMT people because they often come up with things and they'll say, oh, well, ignore international trade. Well, you can't. This is Australia. We have a huge amount of international trade. We can't ignore that aspect of our economy. Sure, you might not default on your debt locally, but when you look at the practical outworkings, there's plenty of examples of countries that have defaulted on their own local debt. So it's actually not uncommon. And then when you think about all the things in terms of how many people really can print their own currency without consequences, well, Japan's done a pretty good job of it.
Very sorry, guys. We've definitely got a problem with Jonathan in terms of microphone. What we might do is we might get him to reset his microphone at the moment, and I'll just give you a quick some quick thoughts, I guess, around So as Jonathan said, you know, his the thought process for him was that as he said, he's not a full Austrian, and I think with anyone, you take any of these to their extreme settings, and I think what you'll find with any of them at the extreme settings is it starts to create problems. And so for me, it's very much is a matter of working out which of these are the ones that will work, and which are the ones that sort of won't work in terms of the and which of the ones have elements that can be incorporated into the whole picture. I think there's is that Jonathan back?
Yeah, back on. Sorry, Jens.
Right. Yeah, no worries. I was just talking through from my perspective. You know, I think all of these have things that fit, and at extremes, every single one of them has problems at the extremes, and it's a matter of trying to work out which of them will be helpful at what period of time, As I said, you know, Keynesian spending in the middle of a boom is not particularly good. And the other part for me is working out when you're going to start spending this, because there's this big issue about, especially right now, that really sort of highlights where we've had a lot of spending, and very quickly. And what that means is there hasn't been enough time for companies to go broke yet. You know, we will get them over time, but the question is, do you start bailing out companies? When you start bailing out companies that should actually go broke, then you end up with these zombie companies, and you end up with an economy that's sort of stuck with companies and paying people that really aren't producing what they should be producing. And so that creates just as many problems, and arguably is what part of the issue as to why we never really managed to raise interest rates following the financial crisis, and why we ended up where we are now. Hmm. But I'll put back to you, Jonathan, for Austrian.
Yeah, so just picking up one of Damien's earlier points, the broken window fallacy, that came from a French economist called Frédéric Bastiat. He died 150 years ago. But one of the big things he left us with was this question of what is seen and what is unseen. And so if you want to characterize economists in a very simple way, if you want to give them marks for whether a good economist or a bad economist, the things that are like a bad economist will just focus on the things that you can see right in front of you and the short term. The good economist also thinks about the things that you can't see and that are in the long term as well. So I'll give you a couple of modern examples of what the broken window fallacy kind of looks like. So I watch the news, ABC News at night, and they're going through a series at the moment where they interview people whose houses burnt down as part of the bushfires over summer. And so what you typically see is a family there, their house is burnt down, they're standing near what was their house. Sometimes they're living in a caravan now. There was one couple recently, they were living in tents, etc., and talking about what they think should happen and what the response should be. And almost always they're saying there should be more funding for them, there should be more money given to them. One thing that you never see the ABC journalist asked is, when you built your house and you built your house in the middle of the bushland, did you ever think that a bushfire might come through and burn your house down? You never hear that question. And another question you don't hear is, you don't have any insurance. Why not? Why did you think living in a bushfire-prone area and not having insurance on your house was a good idea? And this is where we start to get in the area of moral hazard, that if you bail out people, everyone else starts to make these same sort of mistakes. But if you take a hard line with people, and I recognise it is a hard line, then people start to recognise what they should do. So what should happen at this time of year when it's winter and the bushfire risk is low, is that governments would come out and say, well, now's the time to chop down the trees around your house so you've got a bit of a zone there if there's a fire that comes along. Now's the time to get your insurance sorted out. And you might be in a cyclone area or bushfire area or flood area. Get your insurance sorted out so that if something happens, there is some funds there to assist you. That would be a very sort of Austrian thinking thing to do, is to think about the crisis before it happens. But we never really see that. Another sort of broken window fallacy that comes up quite a bit these days is people say we should tax the rich, we'll give it to poor people because poor people spend more money. And that is true. Plenty of economics have shown that over the years, that if you give a low-income family $500 a week, they will spend almost all of it. Whereas if you give that to a wealthy person, they won't. They'll do other things, for instance, like saving it and investing it. They will also maybe give away a portion of it in philanthropy. That lost investment is what drives the economy in the long term. When people save and invest, that's how you grow an economy. When you constantly look to debt to grow your economy instead of savings, you're building yourself up for bubbles, you're building yourself up for boom-bust cycles. And so we've lost a lot of that basic economic thinking of savings is a good thing. Saving helps you grow in the long term. Saving helps you withstand crises and downturns when they happen.
So, Jonathan, in terms of when economies get stuck in this whole paradox of thrift stage, what's the solution there for from the Austrian side?
It's basically to step back and let the economy cleanse itself, to allow businesses and consumers that haven't saved to deal with their issues. And that is often compromises on debts, bankruptcy, insolvency, to allow those businesses to exit the economy. And others will come in and take their place. Others who are better managers of their business, who have more capital to invest in a business, will come in and take over where some have left. And a really good example of that is people might remember many years ago Ansett, and there was great calls to bail out Ansett. But Ansett failed, it disappeared, and then Virgin had just started and it got bigger and it took its place. And now we're going through that cycle again where Virgin had far too much debt. They came into a crisis with very little in reserve and they've gotten into trouble and now they're going through bankruptcy. I think it's very likely they come out and there's an airline there on the other side, but it may only be a third or a half the size that it was when they went in, and it will certainly have much less debt.
And hopefully, manage things better going into the next cycle. But I guess there's that question of, I think the moral hazard issue is a major issue, and I'm certainly in terms of the best thing coming out of the Austrian side of it is the moral hazard and that focus about saying yes, we do need to allow a certain extent of that, and if you step in too early with Keynesian stimulus, you're actually just cutting it off. For me, Keynesian stimulus is better once you've actually allowed at least some companies to go broke and sort of got rid of some of that moral hazard issue. It's a question about when is too much in terms of that side, and what's likely. Actually, that's probably a more important question. Is do you think it's actually likely that we're going to see many companies allowed to fail in this section?
I think there's so many companies that are poorly positioned, it's just inevitable. Particularly on the small business side, government is just not well positioned to assist small businesses to be bailing out, huge numbers with huge quantities of money. On the small business side, they just have to go. There really isn't an option to step in. And even if you provided no interest loans, so many small businesses have seen demand just disappear for months on end. They went into this crisis with very little savings. There just isn't a way out. With bigger businesses, the AFR's been tracking how the federal government gave a whole stack of money to Rex and has kept Rex propped up, but then didn't give anything to Virgin, and Virgin's fallen over. At that sort of end, it's much easier with bigger companies for a government to selectively hand out money. But there's all sorts of issues with you picking winners and losers. There's people who get bailouts, there's people who don't. It's so much easier to just step back and say, actually, those who were well prepared will get through this. Those who weren't prepared, they'll have to talk to their creditors and try and figure a way out with their creditors.
Mm. And creditors might even have to take a loss.
Very much so. We're going to see a lot of that in the years ahead.
An amazing question. I mean, I guess the question on this front is that, right now, I think certainly the stock market seems to be reflecting anyway, is the view that there isn't going to be a debt crisis. Well, certainly, if you took, I suppose, a small data point, but if you took the move in the bank shares over the last sort of 2 days, sort of suggests there's not going to be a debt crisis that is all solved, and they'll keep bailing people out and just keep throwing money at the situation, and we'll probably go into this. I guess along those views, is then you end up in this long, protracted, drawn out, zombie companies sitting everywhere. Is that a likely outcome from what you're saying? You sort of sit more, I guess, on our side of the fence, which is it's very hard to see where that's going to come.
I do think, certainly the last decade, we've seen a whole stack of zombie companies come through in the economies. you know, Europe's one of the worst, Japan's one of the worst, US not so bad, Australia not so bad. But we have long seen the zombie companies coming through. And that's what low interest rates do. That's what quantitative easing do, is they provide the opportunity for capital to be available for companies that wouldn't otherwise survive. And one sort of much more interesting example in a way is you take someone like Uber. Uber doesn't really actually offer a lot in terms of an economic advance. Uber offers a cheaper equivalent to taxis, yes, but the way they do that is that they get around the taxi regulations, so they don't have to buy a taxi license for $400,000 or whatever it is these days. They don't have to comply with minimum wages, and they've got a whole bunch of shareholders who've given money to the company who then turn around and subsidise people who take rides in the Uber system. So you look at something like that, that's the sort of zombie that you've seen in more recent times, which people talk about, oh, it's great advance, it's great for the economy, it's moving things forward. It's just another form of taxi, which has gotten around a whole bunch of regulation and is using existing capital to get the cost of rides down. If it can't produce a profit, it's not sustainable in the long term, and eventually the shareholders give up on it. So that's the sort of zombie activity we've seen quite a bit in the last 10 years, that the Silicon Valley, the startup mentality, and some of them, a very small fraction, go on to be great and do really helpful things. But a lot of them are really just stepping into industries where other people were making decent profits, not huge profits, decent profits, and trying to barge their way in and take over, but not actually making a profit along the way, many of them reporting large losses.
So maybe WeWork might be a better example there. It's in terms of they haven't really reinvented office spacing. They just sort of rebranded it and raised a lot of capital at a very low prices and I guess now are facing exactly that problem in terms of oversupply and you're doing a short term lending versus long term, and effectively the only reason they were funded to where they were funded was because they could get such cheap debt and move into that market.
Yeah, certainly WeWork is another very good example of a business that really doesn't have good long-term foundations. It wasn't a difficult one to pick because there was an equivalent of it going back about 20 years ago of a business that did this same sort of thing with office space, rent large office space, subdivide it, lease it out to smaller tenants who went bust during the tech wreck. So it's simply the same business model rolled out again. And now we're seeing their business model fall apart as they start defaulting on their leases and telling people they can't pay anymore. And there's some businesses out there who've lent the large amount of their floor space to WeWork and are now finding that whilst they thought they had, a building that was fully rented and they were going to receive good payments for many years, they've now got a tenant that's on the way to going broke in some instances. And so it really hasn't been any great change to the economy, any great advancement. It's just another way that people have thrown capital at the wall and found out that they don't get much for it.
Mm. So I guess in terms of forecasting going forward, so from an Austrian point of view, QE is... we're in for low interest rates for forever, I suppose, from that perspective, from an Austrian school. Is that right?
Well, I guess it comes back to the beauty parade versus the debate. If people recognise the debate and think about the long term and think about all the negative spin-offs that we get from implementing, then people will say, actually, no, we need to stop doing this. We need to go back to normal economic policy that has served us well for centuries and has seen economies grow dramatically and people's quality of life improve dramatically. So if we see people kind of awaken and recognise the damage that QE does, then what we're likely to see is a period of maybe 5 to 10 years of underperformance economically, and that's going to hurt. But if you don't, you then start looking at you know, we're going to end up like Japan going nowhere for 25, 30 years.
I guess the, one of the other sides to the argument is and I guess one that I find it most attractive is in terms of saying economies have a certain amount of productive capacity that can happen. And when you go through a downturn, then you lose a chunk of productive capacity that you could have otherwise done. Not really because the economy can't do it, more that it's just people are arguing about how to divide the spoils, so to speak. You're saying we've got enough people and enough resources to produce, whatever, 100 units, but we're only going to produce 95 units because there's an argument about who's getting paid too much and who's getting too much money and who's not, and possibly wages need to come down to certain sectors. And so those people are going to go out of business because they don't want to take wage cuts. And so to me, it's about trying to find the mix of these different solutions that sort of minimizes your short-term pain, but also provides you with a sustainable longer-term growth. And it seems at the moment we seem to be going for let's try and go for almost no short-term pain with the view that forget about long-term, that'll just happen when we get there and we'll run into other problems. I don't know how you see that do you feel as if you just need this cathartic, you know, you need the fire to come through and to burn everything out and then start again?
A constant battle of can you implement the best economic policies when it doesn't work within a three-year political cycle? It's very, very hard. The political interests get involved and it's very hard to turn off the tap.
Yeah, so is there any chance the tap gets turned off? I mean, that's what we're looking at is saying, you know, I guess that's what where I was coming to at the start is saying there's a bit about how should these things be done, and so if they're not being done, we know the recovery is going to be a lot worse or a lot weaker than it could have otherwise been. But the flip side is, can we see can you see governments changing? And I think it's probably my issue is I find it very hard to see central banks changing. They've sort of gone, well, we've started QE, we may as well finish the job. And governments are spending money like we've never seen before in terms of, I mean, we've misplaced $60 billion and it's just a rounding error. Let's just move on to the next issue.
Actually, on that note, Damien, we might jump across to the 14 reasons QE's terrible economic policy, if you like. To run through, it sounds like we've covered off on a few of these already, actually, just through that last piece.
Yeah, definitely. We have. I think Jonathan's just, is he resetting his...
back again. Sorry,
back again. Yeah. So yeah. We've got the 14 reasons for the QE's terrible economic policy up, just with that chart of recoveries from credit bust. I don't know if you wanted to talk to that for a minute, Jonathan.
So I'll run through these very quickly. We simply don't have enough time for detail on all of them, but things like QE and low interest rates, they all incentivize risk taking. They're trying to pull demand forward in terms of investment activity and spending. So that's something we very clearly see. The flip side to that, it disincentivizes saving. And so we see central banks running around and saying there's a glut of saving, that's why interest rates are. You get two lies in one with that statement. There isn't a glut of savings. QE has to be brought in because there's a lack of savings. And rates are low because central banks set them low. That's very simple, very logical. It's not hard to get your head around.
That sounds a little bit like MMT there, Jonathan.
Yes.
We went straight into that. Let's keep going with this one, otherwise.
Moral hazard. So basically, if you let people have bailouts, everyone sees that and they say, well, I want a bailout too. I'm not going to reduce my risk. I'm going to expect a bailout. Inflating asset prices. So if you push down the risk-free rate, bond prices go up, property prices go up, equities go up. We've seen the boom bust cycle. So in the US, they had the tech bubble in 2000, the housing bubble in 2008, and this one's been called the everything bubble. We just keep going up and down and up and down, and people don't recognize that, you know, the Austrian view says, let's pull back, let's let some failure happen, let people learn lessons, build their savings up again, stop taking so much risk, and this boom bust cycle can not necessarily stop, but be substantially lessened. Reducing productivity, One of the really bizarre things that most people don't seem to get is in the last decade in Australia, we've completely ignored the Productivity Commission, and then we wonder why wages aren't growing and productivity's low. It's pretty obvious we're doing the exact wrong things to create productivity rather than, you know, letting the economy and businesses invest and find the ways to increase productivity. We're getting in the way of that. Wealth inequality, whoever owns the assets gets the biggest benefit from QE and from low interest rates. That's really simple, but there's some economists who want to argue against that. Whoever has the most debt gets the most benefit from QE and low interest rates. Central banks have lost their independence. So if a government's running a big deficit and the central bank leaves interest rates at the same level, the cost of that deficit compounds year after year. The interest you have to pay builds up and builds up. And eventually the government's going to default or they have to pull back on spending. But if the central bank sets interest rates at really low levels and helps out with QE, then you can just keep spending for a long time. That then flows into wastefulness in terms of government spending, because if there's very little consequence for running up the debt, why not just keep spending? You don't have to be careful about all the components of your spending. You can just keep going with a whole bunch of programs that shouldn't be there. Eventually, you will get inflation. Certainly, we've seen asset price inflation over the last decade. We haven't seen so much on the consumer inflation side, but eventually that will come.
That one I'll push back on.
One of the lessons over the many centuries of fiat money is that if you manufacture your currency like toilet paper, people will treat it like toilet paper. And that's the MMT side just doesn't seem to get that argument. You just can't keep printing money without there being no consequence. There is a consequence. But the government now owns so many private companies or chunks of private companies that causes real issues around how do you control your economy, who's in charge. Pension plan problems. So you've pushed up asset returns in the short term through QE, but over the long term, they're going to fall. So that destroys pension plans. People retired, they thought they were going to get $5,000 a month, but that gets cut to $1,500 a month and their lifestyle's substantially changed. Social breakdown issues. So in Japan, you've got elderly people who are going to jail because at least in jail they have food and shelter. There's a whole bunch of social cohesion issues that get ignored when you don't deal with them in a proper economic way, when you resort to all these emergency stimulus measures. And a country like Argentina, who's gone through several hyperinflation cycles, is another example of it. It doesn't work. It just leads to problem after problem. And you do need to confront the economic problems. And I guess probably the last one that really sums up everything else is that ultimately debt brings consumption forward. So all of these policies are stealing from future generations. We're basically saying you can deal with lower economic growth. You can deal with the debt repayments and the interest repayments in the future. We just want the most economic growth we can have now, and we're going to leave the bill with the future generations. So that's a whole bunch of reasons. There's probably a whole stack more, and I'd love people to write to me and say, hey, you missed this one or that one. But there's a whole bunch of reasons of why QE just is not a good long-term economic policy.
Thanks for that, John. Damien?
I've got a pushback on a couple. One is the inflation side of it. Not that is more than I think in terms of inflation is that we haven't seen the inflation, and in terms of the way it's increasing, it's exacerbating the wealth inequality. I think that is actually causing issues in terms of making that inflation problem worse. And so I think some of these are intermixed with other problems, I guess.
Sure.
I would say the wealth inequality one is that's one. I'm very big on that in terms of a lot of people don't spend. If you give, as you said, $500 to a poor person, they spend it straight away. You give it to Jenny Reinhart and she throws it on the pile. And so you don't get that sort of recirculating in the economy. And that helps keep demand low, which then keeps inflation low. The question is, if QE was spent on other factors. And I guess this is the argument of the MMT, which I find more attractive, is that if you then spent that on things that lessen the inequality, then you actually create, that actually helps to fix some of the problems in terms of the inflation, and helps fix some of the problems in terms of that inequality, and makes the QE less of an issue. I guess for me, QE that goes back into buying government bonds or into bailing out the mates of governments because they're running companies that ran into trouble, or trying to pick winners in sectors, I'm completely on board with you. That's just setting us up for a longer term negative. But it does look as if that's the world we're living in, and because that's the world we're living in, I think a lot of your points end up being true because of what's happening with the QE money, as opposed to whether QE in itself is a bad thing. And I guess that, to me, that's coming from that point about saying, if there's inequality out there and I can just give, and I give everyone, if there's too much inequality and I just gave everyone $10,000 tomorrow, well, the inequality has been lessened because there's a bunch of people out there who had no money and now they've all got $10,000. And the people who had, $10 million or $10 billion, well, now they've got $10 billion and $10,000. They haven't really noticed the difference, but we have lowered the inequality. And so, so I guess they're my pushbacks to your initial one, is it's QE, to me, the biggest problem is where it's being spent, not as much as on whether it's being done or not.
Yeah. So I can definitely give partial points to that. The sort of helicopter money, just toss it out and everyone gets a bit. That is a good vote winner, and certainly it does spread it around more. Whereas the QE that we've seen has really just gone into assets. You buy back government bonds. People who have portfolios with government bonds turn around, they buy some investment grade bonds. People who had those investment grade bonds, maybe they buy some high yield bonds. People who had the high yield bonds buy some equities. And so it flows through the whole system that way. So I agree with you there. One of the problems, though, and this comes back to basic economics, is the wealth inequality discussion is really problematic and it's the wrong focus. So there's multiple ways to think about inequality. Wealth equality is the easiest one to look at because people go, oh, that person has $1 billion, that person has nothing, that's not fair. But it's far more complicated than that, because another way to look at inequality is income inequality. So someone who earns a massive salary versus someone who doesn't, and you say, well, that's unfair too. Neither of those is the true test of inequality. The ultimate test of inequality is spending power. And when you look at that, you start to understand that capitalism, whilst there's many flaws in capitalism, is the thing that actually works to lift people's living standards. Because when you look at what poor people can afford to spend, it's far, far larger than what you think, and it's far, far larger than their income, because the income that they earn from work can often be quite low, but the income from government benefits is quite a substantial number. So just as a quick example, prior to the JobKeeper and JobSeeker payments, one of the papers I read from a poverty-focused group added up the payments that a family could get. So mum, dad, both unemployed, two kids in school, plus, so there's two unemployment payments, there's benefits because they've got kids and they're low-income people, plus you add on some rent assistance, the family can be receiving in the order of $1,000 a week. It's a little bit below that. Now with JobKeeper and JobSeeker, it's well over $1,000 a week. So that's a very substantial amount of money that goes to people who aren't working. And if you compare that to, say, what happens in middle-income and low-income countries, you're just miles in front of where they would be there. That because our economy has grown so much, because there's so much productivity going on, we can afford to pay such large welfare systems, and people who are unemployed can live, in comparison to other countries overseas, quite well without having to work.
Yeah, and the other argument would, the opposite argument though, would say that because we've got such inequality of incomes, we have to do these transfers because otherwise these people can't survive in our economy. And arguably as well, over the last 20 odd years, we've basically said to people, well, because we've got falling interest rates, you might not be able to afford the lifestyle you want, from your income, but we'll let you borrow so that you can still have your lifestyle. But we'll have you'll have to take it out in debt what you can't earn in terms of your earnings. Anyway, I feel as if that's one we could get stuck in for a while, given the time.
Yeah, I was just going to say, do you want to jump across the investment?
Jonathan, well, actually, I wouldn't mind just quickly, Jonathan, some of your thoughts in terms of so Jonathan, for anyone who hasn't listened into the other ones, manages distressed debt portfolios. I'm just interested in some of your thoughts around which of the areas of the Australian economy. So let me take one step back in terms of the question is, if we treat it as being saying we've sort of suspended reality for the moment in the Australian economy, when we're not letting companies go broke, we're giving people big payments even though they're unemployed, and we're not kicking people out of homes even if they can't pay the rent. So we've sort of suspended reality for a little while, and in a couple of months we'll be coming out of that. From what you're seeing on the ground, what are the main key sectors where you've got concerns at the moment that aren't going to be able to, as we come out of this, are going to be the key real spot for where we see the danger, where we see companies go broke?
Yeah, good question. Coming into this crisis, retail was in trouble, and that's just been accelerated. So that won't be a surprise to anyone. We've seen quite a wave of retail insolvencies in the last year, and that will just worsen. Construction.
Before we go through the retail, so that was retail in terms of the retailers. What about the commercial property behind that?
Oh, yeah. So there's obviously big issues there. If you look at shopping centres, I'm probably a little bit more optimistic on shopping centres that they will come back in a reasonable fashion. So people keep going to shopping centres to get their groceries at least. And eventually they'll start to feel more comfortable and they'll go back to the specialty retailers. The ones that are most problematic will be the ones that have got the Myers and the David Jones. Those sort of middle high income, large format stores have been suffering for a long time, and we may well see those businesses go into insolvency here. They just really struggle to find a foothold in what consumers want to spend. But certainly the smaller shopping centres that are built around a supermarket, I think those will continue to do okay. Mm. But with specialty retail, particularly those sort of discretionary items, you don't really need them. I think there's going to be a lot of those discretionary retailers going to the shopping centre owner saying, I can only pay you half the rent. Look at my numbers. I seriously cannot pay you the full rent. Do you want me to close up and move out, or can we get the rent down? And so I think there will be a lot of that activity going on.
Mm. So, but you were saying to me yesterday that you didn't think the debt issues were anywhere near what the problems were in the financial crisis in that sector?
Oh, certainly not. I can remember during the crisis, some of the big listed property trusts had three rounds of equity raising to get on top of their debt. And I think now most of them, I'm not following it super closely, but most of them are between 20 and 35% gearing of the listed property trusts. So that leaves them in a position where they've got options. You can raise a little bit of equity. Maybe you just stop the dividends for a year and that helps you get on top of things. So there certainly are options for them when you have low debt levels. You've got reserves. You've got something to fall back on. So I'm not sure that we'll need to see that, you know, second round, third round of raisings to kind of keep the banks happy that the debt levels aren't too high this time.
Mm. Okay, and then construction sector, you were saying was next?
Well, if you take population growth out of the picture, we simply don't need as many homes. And offices and shopping centres, who's going to want to expand and build new ones at this point in the economic cycle when the question is, do we have too many of them rather than too little? So I think construction is really lining up for a bruising. I struggle to see that won't be a sector where there'll be a substantial pullback in both employment and in the amount of units and commercial property being built.
Mm. Yep. Any other sectors that sort of spring to mind in terms of where you've got concerns? Well, you're just saying the infrastructure spend will step in for some of the economy, but it won't be enough to offset the losses on the rest of the that you're getting from other construction.
Yeah, they're not completely interchangeable. The types of engineering and the types of people you need to build infrastructure are a little different in some cases from the ones you need to build a, you know, 30, 40 story unit block.
Yeah.
So it's not as easy as some people try and make it sound.
Yep. And then banks kicking people out of houses, how much do you think of that we'll see as the moratorium periods finish up and, I guess, or the non-conforming lenders versus the banks?
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of political pressure on the major banks. So the governments will try and encourage the banks to let people have the maximum amount of time to try and find another job and get their payments back on track. And I think what that probably becomes is if you can pay the interest on your debt, there'll be a fair amount of patience with you as long as you can keep the debt stable or at least reducing a little bit, then I think the bank probably keeps giving you time. But if you've had a very high income job and then you go on to the unemployment benefits and you've had to turn both your principal and interest off and the debt's building up, I think that's where banks will give you some time, but eventually they're going to say, you need to put your house on the market, you need to sell it, and if you don't, then we have to foreclose and we have to sell it. So, you know, they'll be putting that pressure on borrowers to make the decision to sell themselves. And that's the sort of thing that often creeps under the radar, that the bank has put the pressure on and the person recognises the logic of it and goes through that process, and you don't necessarily see that this is a person who's in financial trouble. They are, but because the bank hasn't taken possession of the property, you can't see it.
Right, okay. And I think I was talking about the whole part about you know, prisoner's dilemma that the banks are facing in terms of if you're a bank, you know, the onus is and you're seeing lots of people in trouble. You'd like to try and get those people. You'd like to try and get them off your books, get them all to sell their houses, and get your money back. But if every bank decides to do that, then we have a housing crash. And so I guess you're saying here, I guess you're suggesting that the major banks probably aren't going to play that game. The second tier lenders and the non-conforming. Do you think they might try and take advantage of that by trying to get their customers out as soon as they can?
I think we could see a bit of that. So the way the businesses are set up is quite different. So a major bank, it's shareholders, so they're a little bit distant. So whilst the banks ultimately report to their shareholders, they are also much more subject to political pressures because they're larger, but also the people who run banks, they do have an incentive to see the share price go well. But it's not as direct as a private lending business where the owner is in control, is often the CEO. They're there on a day-to-day basis. And every loan that goes bad is a loan that they take a personal hit on. So I think that the non-banks are probably much more likely to look to give people time but not extended time to solve their problems. Because they will personally bear the pain, whereas banks, it's ultimately your shareholders who bear the pain, which is a little bit more distant.
We might jump to the investment ones. We can write those up later if we get on again.
All right, sure thing. Likely outcomes, Damien.
Yeah, so I think the main thing for me was that's of interest is this thought about these creating zombie companies and This is probably where we're really focused, and as I think we're on the same page as Jonathan in terms of looking at that small and medium business sector as being the key part, which is very hard for governments to bail out en masse without creating some really massive moral hazard. So maybe there will be, you know, the next whatever it is, next spare $60 billion we've got will go into funding a whole bunch of companies, but I mean we've already seen that the government's trying to. They announced they'd give $40 billion in loans to small and medium businesses, and the banks so far have given away, I think maybe one or two
mm-hmm.
billion, and we're halfway through. So the banks certainly don't want to get out and lend to small and medium businesses in the time of a downturn. And Jonathan, actually, I was asking a little bit of a Dorothy Dixer in terms of I'd spoken to him yesterday a bit about this, and he's saying that some of those non-conforming guys that have high levels of small and medium businesses, they're some of the most likely to be looking at calling their loans because they've got some problems.
Okay.
So you know, for me, the real investment implications is looking at these zombie companies. So the more zombie companies we get created, probably the better it is in the very short term. But definitely the worse it will be in the medium term. And when I say medium term, I'm talking, you know, 3-4 years, even close, probably 2 years. So you'll miss some of the downside, but if you create all these zombie companies, you're very much stuck in this low growth, you know, and low interest rates for the foreseeable future. I think the unfettered spending is sort of the path of least resistance. So what I'm saying there is that, you know, Keynesianism, as for its Jonathan has his complaints with it, but I think even his acknowledging that it is a path of least resistance for companies and governments, and that while QE's got its problems as well, quantitative easing, so central banks just spending money, that's also the path of least resistance at the moment, and so. You know, trying to work out how much gets done is one of the issues. The unfettered destruction. So I guess that's the Austrians' argument in terms of saying, you know, you should just let a lot of companies go broke and then you pick up the pieces afterwards. I think that can go too far, but I think we certainly need a chunk of that, and we certainly haven't seen anywhere near enough destruction in the previous crisis. And so it's almost as if in response in this crisis, we've gone even earlier trying to have less destruction. And so we've sort of been arguing we've been discussing for a while, and we had the podcast, you know, a week or two ago just saying, you know, is this the big one? Is this the time when you finally see our long-term debt, which builds up gradually over cycle, is this the time where that finally comes unraveled? And maybe it won't be. Maybe everything will... You know, so many things will get bailed out that you know, we'll go for one last hurrah. I do think small and medium businesses will be too much for it, but that's what the key place to watch, I guess, in terms of government spending. That's where if we were going to come out much faster, then getting a solution to the small and medium business problem would be key to that. And then the other part about, you know, there's the last point there I've got is that there's these four types of gearing you have, and it's a question of saying when you've got lots of debt out there, you can either have governments with lots of debt, you can have corporates with lots of debt, you can have consumers with lots of debt, or you can actually have this inequality where, let's say it's within consumers, where consumers don't actually have that much debt as a whole, but certain pockets of consumers have stacks of debt, and then other pockets of consumers have got lots of savings. And so, you know, when you net them out. And at the moment, depending upon which different countries have different levels, you know, Australia is very much focused on the consumer debt and to a certain extent, a little bit the inequality. The inequality is bad, but not as bad as in other countries. You look at, say, the US, it's more the corporate and more the inequality side. In terms of China, you know, similar type of factor. It's less of the consumer, more of the corporate, more of the inequality. And so, a lot of policy is about trying to work out how can we switch between the two. You know, if we in Australia, it's about can we leverage up the government a bit more in order to so that we don't have to have this downturn and everything will be fine. But this game eventually ends, and I figure that. Yeah, I keep coming back to that small and medium business and basically the solution would be you take a huge amount of government debt out and you transfer it across to small and medium and you transfer it across to help save small and medium businesses, and that'll probably get you through without a major crisis. But beyond that happening, I find it difficult to see what the path ahead is.
Okay, very good. Just on that note, we might jump into a couple of questions as well, Damien. You mentioned China before. I've got a question here, just wanting or curious to know on the future of the yuan. So if the political risk in Hong Kong results in no more Hong Kong dollar, or at least an altered one, and if China prints significantly this year, how will this affect, you know, everything?
Yeah, look, the Chinese, I mean, you go back 6 months ago and this type of event in Hong Kong might have caused the market to fall, you know, 4 or 5%, and this event's been going on the last week and the market's risen probably a similar level. So it's sort of I think the market's very much in this bad news is good news. Mm. Oh, things are terrible in Hong Kong. It looks like the trade war is going to be starting. Oh, that means more money will need to be more QE, more government spending. So therefore buy stocks. So you know, my take is that I think there's I think there's quite a dangerous setup happening in Hong Kong. And the question will be how much pushback you get from the US. I think Trump is very much looking for an excuse to paint China as the enemy. Mm. I suspect he would actually prefer to make it mainly a war of words, and less of actions. But this Hong Kong's certainly going to be an issue, and depreciating yuan as well is going to be is now a question back to Trump. You know, is it going to be just a war of words, or are you going to follow up with actions? And who knows with Trump? I suspect he'll have to step up with some real actions, because he's coming into an election and he wants to be the guy who's tough on China. But I don't know. Nobody knows what Trump's going to do next.
Jonathan, any thoughts on much coverage of Hong Kong debt or any, you know, that side of the world?
Oh, not so much. I guess the main thing I'd say about China is, in regards to the discussion that we've had, is that up to about 2008, China grew really quickly and they were a country that had a lot of domestic savings. And that's typically what we saw with a lot of the Asian countries. They grew very well because they had a lot of savings and a lot of investment. But China flipped and has become like the Western economies after 2008. And it's just gone on an enormous debt binge that we've never seen an emerging market country go on such a binge before. China's a really interesting test case, an authoritarian government that has more levers it can pull than other countries, but it's flipped from being a savings-generated growth economy to a debt-generated growth economy, and that debt-generated growth inevitably falls apart.
And actually, the other thing I'd add to that is that's one of the ones I quite like. Michael Pettis does some really good analysis on this, but you know, one of his is saying that you know a lot of the reason is that because they've repressed consumers. So if you repress the consumer spending, then that frees up their savings in terms of you know the money's got to go somewhere, so it can then go into an investment. And so the solution really for that is you actually need to switch money from corporates over there and governments and put it back in the hands of consumers. But you know, if you go out and stimulate, and you go out and build more apartments, or you go out and build more roads and bridges and all that type of stuff, that does nothing for switching back to consumers. All you're doing is more of the same. And so, I think they recognise they're in this very unstable relationship where they're just spending more, you know, spending for the sake of spending. And we've likened it to the Russia going broke, trying to just building up its military to try and fight with the US, whereas it seems here is that China's whole thing is just keep building more apartments, keep building more infrastructure, and at some stage it's just useless. So that military spending, building all the bombs and tanks and all that type of stuff, didn't put food on the table for the people, and it's the same thing in China and airports and stuff like that aren't being used, ends up in the same part. You know, it's ineffective spending, and so doesn't actually go to creating a better economy going forward.
Just in interest of time, we've probably just got time for one last question here. One just dropped in. So Senator Rennick is extolling the virtues of expanding the balance sheet with a national bank that invests in public infrastructure as a way of driving growth with lower business input costs. So what are your thoughts on this idea, gentlemen?
Look, I'm a fan of well-targeted infrastructure. I'm not a fan of infrastructure that's on the basis of
bridges to nowhere.
which electorate do we really need to win next one? And so can we target a rowing club that really needs some extra money? So yeah, we've got an infrastructure Australia that's got a list of projects that they think are worth doing and a positive in terms of that sense. So I think they probably need to be recast a little bit for the nature of what we're in now. So let's say if you want to build infrastructure for more, you might be taking the foot off the accelerator in terms of more public transport at the moment. If it looks like the virus is going to hang around for a while, and one of the losses from that is that people aren't traveling as much on public transport.
Mm-hmm.
So you know it needs to be targeted and it needs to be make sure that it is paying for itself. But as long as from that perspective, do you need a national bank? So I'm assuming that would then just have a bunch of government money stuck into it, you know, so that it can actually fund these. Or I don't know whether that's particularly different from the government doing it itself. But if you need that sort of, if they need a mental break, and that means that this thing can actually invest in public infrastructure on the basis of whether it is a good thing or not, rather than whether it's going to win votes at the next election, then I'm positive for that.
You might find maybe they could it could roll into some sort of a retail based infrastructure bond or something, perhaps with a higher rate.
I mean, I guess the thing for us is, you know, in terms of lower business input costs is important insofar as if it's an area where that is an issue and more capacity will help. There's probably areas where they're not capacity constrained, and so you know adding that infrastructure, say for you know, let's say you've got government expenses to go out and build a bunch of iron ore ports or more ports to get more resources out when we think those resources are already producing it close to maximum. You know, that's probably not going to be as useful as something to actually try and flip the economy back towards, you know, maybe an NBN that works. You know, maybe we could have a works better. Oh, sorry. Actually, sorry. Here's one question here. Sorry, one third thing. Sorry, the comment is the suggestion is fiscal policy from the RBA as opposed to the RBA printing money to buy Australian government bonds. Yes, I'd certainly support that. Fiscal policy, it's effectively a type of QE. Sorry, more QE for the people, you know, sending it straight into the National Bank that buys infrastructure rather than via a government. So, yep. Jonathan, what do the Austrians think?
Look, I think going back to the infrastructure point, there is plenty of cheap debt out there. And there's plenty of equity from the super funds and others who will back good infrastructure projects. The problem is we simply run out of the easy projects now. All of the ones that will be helpful will cost a lot of money, and it's marginal whether they are going to be profitable. And so that's the problem. It's very easy to say build infrastructure. It's far more difficult to figure out which infrastructure we should build if we want to get a long-term economic benefit. And if it was so obvious that there were so many infrastructure projects that were going to be profitable, the private sector would have jumped on them a long time ago.
That's a good point.
Green New Deal, maybe? Green New Deal, maybe, Jonathan? What would you go from the Green New Deal? Is that a...
Look, I have a belief that hydrogen is probably that mid-fuel that we really need. And that the science isn't there yet, but in 5 to 10 years it could be. So if people say, well, where's an area of government investment? That would be one is, you know, the CSIRO, the universities and others working on hydrogen and turning that into a cheaper way to have a fuel that we can use around the clock. That would be very helpful for our energy grid. But to be clear, that would be an investment in science as opposed to just chucking money around at random things.
Exactly. And I could even go one step further to say, let's make it an investment in science and they can work out whether it wants to be hydrogen or solar panels or whatever it is. Let's make it technology agnostic. And then rather than picking a winner as, say, carbon capture or something like that. Yes.
Fair point.
Very good. Okay, well, look, run a little bit over time today, so we're very thankful for you hanging around, Jonathan. Would you like to share with our viewers ways to get in touch and follow some of your work?
Yeah, everyone's welcome to jump on the website, narrowroadcapital.com. You can read the articles. The little bar will pop up at the bottom if you want the monthly newsletters. The next newsletter will be coming out in a couple of days, so do feel free to sign up for that. You can see my articles on Livewire pretty regularly, also on First Links. They also publish some of my work. And do feel free to ping me. There's a contact box on the website as well. If you write something that's not particularly rude, I'm very likely to respond.
We'll wait and see how we go after the topics covered today. So look, thanks again for joining us. We look forward to getting you back on the show very soon, Jonathan.
Greatly appreciate your time, gents.
Thanks, mate. And thanks to you, Damien, for a big chat there. And, certainly a wonderful compilation. I think we've been coverage of the various areas and facets of debt. And I'm sure there's going to be plenty more to come as well. I will jump across now to coming up next week. So we've got another special guest, another friend of the show, Martin North. He has recently completed his latest household survey numbers. So we'll be getting him on the show to run through those and of course, bring forward again the Australian property theme to our show. And it's always very widely listened to and very popular. So we're looking forward to that one. Thursday, the 4th of June, 12:30 p.m. Or lunchtime, as always. And feel free to follow us live there, of course, and you can pop in some questions and get them answered along the way. So I hope you've enjoyed today's episode, and just some few final notes. So if you'd like to see more of our content, such as articles and performance reports, head on over to nucleuswealth.com/content to stay up to date on news from us, and follow us on social media. So you can find us by simply searching Nucleus Wealth in Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. We, of course, always appreciate guest or topic suggestions. So if you've got one, feel free to drop them in the comments of today's YouTube video. We'll pick those up and we can have a look and do some research and maybe put some invites out there for some from future guests. And finally, if you prefer to listen to these episodes, shows, of course, can be found in all podcast form in all major and minor podcast platforms. So on that note, thanks very much for tuning in. Thanks to everyone listening in live and for popping in your questions and also some comments around a very big topic and a hotly debated topic. And we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.